Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
This is a More Than Just Podcast production.
Alrighty then. Welcome to Spotcast Season 4, Episode 26. My name is Tim Mitchell. I'm in Toronto, Ontario. I'm joined once again by Jonathan Kuhline in the comic book cave in
Mississauga, Ontario. Welcome to my cave. I hope everybody got to see my excellent picture on social media.
Well, you will. You'll see it on the, if you look at the cover art for this episode.
There you go.
There you go. We're also joined by Jaime Lopez Jr., who I don't know how many comic books Jaime has. He never talks about his massive collection of comic books, so... Over there in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going? And I don't really have many here. I'd have to rack my brain to think what I have here. I have some in sort of like semi-storage at my my dad's house. Mm-hmm. It's kind of just taking space. I never brought those to Seattle. They're there. And then probably some, you know, digitally in Comixology.
Yeah, I think I have some digital comic books as well, but I think some of the apps that I used, like, well, didn't Marvel or DC or somebody have an app a while ago? I remember having a Spider-Man issue. I don't know where it's gone, though. It was on my iPad.
Yeah, Marvel and DC both have apps, and then Comixology sort of covers all of them, and theoretically you should be able to share them, but you have to sort of keep track of your collection in a virtual space, which is kind of weird.
Yeah, I'll have to go and figure out where my... Because I haven't looked at a comic book in a while. I don't know. Did we read them in iBooks? I can't remember how we used to access them, but...
Through any of those apps, they're quite good. The readers are actually really quite good on those.
Okay, I'll have to go and find my... Because I know I had some comic books early in the iPad, you know, existence kind of thing. Anyway, are you in your cave there, the one we posted a picture of?
Yeah, I got a lot of popular response to that one. That was very funny. Yeah. A lot of people commenting like, oh my God, I want to live in that room. Like, yeah, you can't. It's my room. Get out of here.
Yeah. Somebody on Facebook, Jaime probably sees their posts on Facebook because he's a friend of mine there. But one of his friends said, you know, you got more stuff in there than the
Silver Snail. Yeah.
Yeah. Silver Snail was one of the comic book stores down on Queen Street downtown. Yeah. They've moved, haven't they? Are they gone?
Yeah, they moved. They were down on Queen Street initially, and then they moved up to just north of Yonge and Dundas Square. And now they've moved back out to Queen Street, but further out. So they're like Queen.
Yeah. Much smaller when they moved up to Yonge Street, right?
Yonge Street is actually a pretty sizable store, all things equal. They're up on the second floor over top of Winners or something like that. Next to the movie theater there. It was actually a decent sized store. The place they're in now is smaller. I went there because they were having a post-holiday sale. I went there maybe 3 weeks ago and just popped in. And it's pretty small. Like I genuinely think I have more comics between my library and my basement. I think I have more comics here than they do, genuinely.
Wow. Yeah.
Which is, it's not what you want.
Ideally, you don't want to keep too much inventory if you're in that business, right?
Well, it's strange because like Snail always had this massive backstock supply, but I've gone to a ton of, you know, different places, different stores, flea markets, all kinds of places over the years. Snail used to stamp their books or put like their custom labels on books. On the bags, that is. And I see their inventory everywhere. So I think they must have sold off. Like, I think they had warehouses full of stuff. I think they must have sold off warehouses full of inventory. I don't think they have what they used to. I don't think they are the place anymore.
Well, what is the place now in Toronto?
Ooh, good question. For back issues? Boy. Depends what you're looking for. If you're looking for, like, good quality older books... Paradise is really good. That's up on Yonge north of St. Clair, I guess, and north of Eglinton, maybe. For just like massive amounts of back issues, like Comic Warehouse is pretty good. That's up in Brampton. There's a handful of them, but there's no like slam dunk. Like if you're looking for an issue, honestly, the best place for back issues right now is a retail store, but it's also an online place. It's called Capt Can, CaptCan. They have an app and they have, I think they say they have 300,000 books in inventory.
Oh.
And they individually scan every book they get. They have, full-time staff dedicated to the web production stuff. They scan everything so you can see exactly what you're buying. It's not just like a you know, stock image or anything. And they do two uploads a week. They do one on a Tuesday and one on a Friday. They upload like anywhere from 500 to 2,000, 3,000 books a week. And yeah, you can just basically pick and pay and pay through Apple Pay and either have it shipped to you or hold it until you have enough to have them send you a box full. And yeah.
So do they... Like, are you buying the issue that you have the picture of, or are you buying an issue of that picture of that ilk?
No, you buy the exact book that you pay for is exactly what you're seeing in the picture.
Okay, yeah. So it's kind of like an eBay kind of deal, whatever.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Cool. Which is good. I've only ever had one book that the scan didn't capture the kind of condition it was in. Usually they're like almost even better than they look in the scans. I did have one recently where I saw the scan and I sort of looked at it. And I was like, oh, that's a good price for that book. I'm missing that one. I'll buy it. And I picked up the book and it was in significantly worse condition than I thought. And I sort of sent a note to the owner and said, you know, I don't want to make a big deal, but I just don't feel like this necessarily reflected the quality of the book. And he was like, oh yeah, no, you're right. The scan didn't show the full damage. And he gave me a refund and told me to keep the book. So.
Well, that's good.
Right. Yeah. So, and they're great. Like I sold the, you know, that I had those boxes, on the floor, all the books and stuff that I was getting rid of. That's who took them. I sold them 260 books, something like that, out of my collection.
Yeah, so. Just scratching the surface, folks, for those who are transporting at home.
Well, is it the guy, so it's a father and son that run the place. The son said to me, oh, so are you like, you just like getting out of it? Or are you like clearing out your collection? I said, sir, this is like 10% of my collection. Yeah, he was just really? Like, oh my God. It's like, sorry.
Yeah, the foundation of Jonathan's house is on comic book boxes.
No. And when I finally go, there's going to be a bonfire of epic proportions.
No. We're hitting eBay, Xavier.
No, come on. No, I'm going to be buried
in it. We're going to scan 400 a week, and we're going to upload them to a website and have an app.
Yeah, no, I think that's Xavier's plan to a T. I think that's exactly what he's got in mind.
Oh, no, we're just going to go to that guy and bring the boxes and say, here you go.
Yeah.
Estate sale.
What's up? I think you'd do well.
No, we know we do well. I'm sure Xavier is planning on building his helicopter fleet with your comic book collection.
Yeah, I did. I've told him multiple times that the will says you can have everything of mine if I go naturally. If you push me off a cliff, you get nothing.
All right.
Don't want to get any ideas, you know.
Yeah. What about the wife and the other son there?
I think that goes for all of them. None of them are allowed to push me off a cliff.
Do they have to arm wrestle for it? Or?
Yeah, none of them are allowed to push me off a cliff. Thank you very much.
Or what is it? They fight to the death? What's a traditional comic book kind of?
Yeah, really. I was going to say for comic books or Germans?
In sort of comic graphic novel world, what do people do? It's to the death or something, right?
Yeah, death by 1,000 paper cuts?
Yes, yeah, that one too. All right, so carrying on to fact check, I actually sat down and spun up the Back to the Future 2 to find out the reference that Nicole was talking about last week, and I'm going to read you from the script. It says, Marty McFly says, Doc, what about Jennifer? What about Einstein? We can't just leave them here, meaning leaving them in the middle universe. And Doc Brown says, don't worry, Marty. Assuming we succeed in our mission, this alternative 1985 will be changed to the real 1985, instantaneously transforming around Jennifer and Einy. Jennifer and Einy will be fine. There will be absolutely no memory of this horrible place. So, go figure.
Which is not really how that would work.
Yeah, no, that's why I've always kind of warned.
Not quantum mechanics, I don't think, but it's a lovely, quick way of saying we don't have to bring the dog and the girl who's unconscious on the rest of this adventure.
Somebody, yeah, and pay them salaries and stuff like that. But somebody must have thought, you know, by the time that story, I mean, because they must have had all three stories or the second and third episode in ready to go and figured there was a paradox they needed to cover up, right? So,
yeah.
But this is a cover up, man.
In theory, it wouldn't have just changed around them. It would have created a divergent timeline, and she'd have been stuck there, waking up on a random porch.
Well, like Marty, when he climbs in the window, and it's some girl's bedroom, not his bedroom, right?
Exactly, yeah. So, lovely notion, but not the case.
By the way, that was at 1 hour, 2 minutes, and 30 seconds of the movie. So, if you really want to check up on me, there you go. And we'll jump into the headlines. Jonathan's up with... I almost read this as The Boys of Summer, which is not what this reference is about. Anyway,
I mean, you could sing along if you'd like.
Boys of Summer is baseball, is what that means.
It is, yes. Isn't that a song? Isn't that a Tom Cochran song? Or My Boy's Gonna Play in the Big Leagues?
No, it's. I thought that was hockey he was talking about. No, that's Boys of Summer is a song by Don Henley.
Oh, Don Henley. That's right. You're right. All right. Well. I will start with the boys are back in town. The boys are back. The much loved series from Amazon Prime is going to be coming back. We finally have a return date, which is exciting. I know that I love season two. I think you guys also enjoyed that. It's coming back on June the 3rd on Amazon Prime Video. This is, of course, based on the comic book series, very popular. It actually got nominated for Emmy Awards this year for Best Drama, which I thought was really a big accomplishment. Maybe that'll draw a few more eyes to the series for season 3. And the fact that obviously it's pretty bingeable, being just the first two seasons. But I'm really looking forward to getting back into the world with Starlight and Homelander, and our two series wonder Jack Quaid, who's the star of The Boys as well as the star of Star Trek Lower Decks.
Boimler himself.
So, yeah, 8 episodes cool. is going to be what they do. It doesn't say here whether or not they're going to, let's see. First 3 episodes are going to drop on June 3rd, followed by 1 new episode a week until the season finale streams on July the 8th. So, again, pretty tight little season for The Boys.
And sadly, our family member, Justin, I don't think he worked on this season. He was working on Lock and Key.
Yeah, he was.
So, yeah. And he's no longer doing that anymore. So, yeah, if you're looking for someone to blow up your set or light it or...
yeah, somebody who's really good with a board.
Yeah,
he's your guy. We highly recommend.
He's the guy.
Yep. Are you guys psyched for season 3 of... Jaime, did you watch The Boys as well?
Yeah, I'm all caught up to season 2.
What did you think of season 2?
Yeah, it was pretty nutty. Pretty nutty.
The whole series is pretty nutty, really, you know? Yeah. It's a nutty series.
All right. Next up, speaking of classics,
Film
Scott
in Toronto.
Pilgrim, one of my favorite films, is coming back, but coming back in a very unusual way. So obviously, Scott Pilgrim versus the World was a really cool movie from a number of years back that was shot here in Toronto, of course, starring Michael Cera as the titular Scott Pilgrim, based on the graphic novels by Brian Lee O'Malley. And it was a really cool Edgar Wright movie. And apparently, it's going to get a new life. So... the anime is coming next. There's going to be an anime version of Scott Pilgrim. And I'm not sure how to feel about this. It is kind of an anime. If you read the series, the style of it, which they do actually incorporate a little bit of Brian's art into the movie. So the flashback scenes where Ramona is talking about her past, and you'll see her as a younger version of herself as a cartoon. That's Brian's art. And it is a little anime-ish as the whole graphic novel series is. So maybe it's a good fit, but it's kind of interesting that this is going to be something that they're going to develop. So, and I'm not sure where the desire to do this comes from. Maybe it's just another kick at the can. I know I love the movie. I know, Tim, you love the movie. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a cult favorite. It certainly did not knock people's socks off in the theater. I think a lot of people discovered it when it moved to streaming and other things. But I don't know where the demand to do this in this form is, or whether there is the audience for it, or maybe this will be a better platform for it than the theatrical movie. But I mean, that theatrical movie was one, I thought it was great and really, really well done. Definitely. But also, like, that was a star machine too. Like, Michael Cera coming off of, Superbad, Arrested Development, that kind of stuff was ascendant. Mary Elizabeth Winstead, as Ramona, was again on the way up.
Mrs. Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Kieran Culkin, who is now one of the biggest stars in the world being on Succession, had a real renaissance and is amazing. He's so funny in that movie. Chris Evans, Brie Larson. So you might have heard of the two of them, Captain America and Marvel, respectively. Anna Kendrick, Brandon Routh, Jason Schwartzman. Like, this thing was just packed. Aubrey Plaza. Like, there, it is just jam-packed with talented stars. Frankly, if you haven't seen it, you should. But it's interesting that the next sort of iteration of this would come in the form of an anime. So yeah,
interesting. So a question is, does the story in the graphic novel, does it take place in Toronto, or just
Yeah, Brian was living here when he wrote that,
right? Okay,
cool. he's since moved down to the States, but yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, in the first issue is a lot of, like, it's pretty fairly true to the story of the movie is fairly true to the story of the books. Obviously, it's not nearly as detailed. It's a 6-book series, so it's different in that way. So there's more, obviously, but, you know, yeah, follows that, where it is, you know, again, the fight scene at Casa Loma, the, you know, them hanging out, walking down past Honest Ed's, browsing through Sonic Boom, all that stuff. That's, you know, that's straight out of the book, because that's where Brian was and living and hanging out with all the people in that community. And yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Cool.
So
we'll claim it as our own. Hopefully they don't change that.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of a thing. I mean, I wrote a piece when I was working at the Toronto Star when the movie came out, and the entertainment editor asked me to write a piece for them about the books set in Toronto, comic books that were set in Toronto, other comic books that were set in Toronto. And so I wrote a piece basically framed around Scott Pilgrim saying, you know, yes, this is one of the, you know, few things that's actually set in Toronto in the book. It's going to be set in Toronto in the movie. What else has been sort of captured in comic books? So I wrote a little summary of maybe like 8 or 10 books that I knew of that were also set in Toronto and where Toronto was a featured component, from, you know, a 2-issue arc of Wonder Woman to some Alpha Flight, which is, of course, a classic comic book set in Canada, to It's Good Life If You Don't Weaken by Seth, which is a fantastic, a beautiful graphic novel that's sort of centered around Toronto and sort of uses Toronto as the backdrop. So, yeah, it was definitely a major part of that story is Toronto being Toronto. And it's fun to see for, you know, we do kind of feel a little forgotten up here, the black sheep of the large cities in North America.
We're Chicago and New York. Don't tell anybody, right?
So. Well, I mean, don't tell the people of Chicago, but we're a bigger city than Chicago is. So, you know, there's only 3 cities in North America that are bigger than Canada, bigger than Toronto, rather. It's Mexico City, New York, Los Angeles, and then Toronto. So it's not, I know everyone thinks we're, you know, south of the border thinks we're a quaint little spot. We're actually huge. So, you know, we have a lot, like, you should see the igloos as far as the eye can see.
Well, I meant, yeah, on the hockey sticks and stuff like that.
And the hockey sticks protecting each one, yeah.
Yeah, but what I meant was that we stand in for New York and Chicago in a lot of movies.
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yes, for sure. Yeah, the number of times that people are like, you know, oh, no, we have to get down to Fifth Avenue. I'm like, you're on Yonge Street.
Yeah. Yeah. Take the Ontario government sign down, maybe. you'll drive by. You'll be driving home and they'll have put a smoke bomb in the sewers to make them look like the steam coming out in New York.
Yeah. The best one is in the Marvel Universe, the MCU's Incredible Hulk, the one starring Ed Norton, there's a huge fight scene at the end of the movie where Abomination and Hulk have this knockdown, throw-out fight that's supposed to be in New York City, and it is just Yonge Street. It's just 100% Yonge Street. It's no effort is made to make it look like a part of New York City. It's just as clear as crystal as at Yonge Street. It's very funny.
And, of course, Casa Loma is the school, Xavier's school in... X-Men series, and the very first scene of the when they're talking about the how bad the X-Men generally are, or mutants generally are, and Magneto and Xavier meet in Professor X meet in the walkway. That's Roy Thomson Hall.
Roy Thomson Hall, yeah, absolutely. Yep. Mm-hmm. Well, and the boys. I mean, the boys is supposed to be set in some other place. It they're using. Roy Thomson Hall over and over again. That's what their headquarters is.
The base of it is, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a lot shorter in real life than it looks like in The Boys.
Yes, definitely that. Cool. Anyway, that's what I got.
Over to you, Jaime.
Continuing the Canadian theme, the takes place in Canada. I forget where. I don't remember if it's
Toronto.
Vancouver. Is it Toronto? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The Turning Red animated film from Pixar is apparently not going to theaters, but is instead going to be on Disney Plus, and it looks like regular Disney Plus. It's not a premier access or anything.
Nice. So,
effectively free if you already have Disney Plus for, let's see, Boba Fett's probably done by then. I don't remember what's out around that time.
Yeah, it's 28th, it says here, right? So, cool. Have you guys seen that other movie that the singing one, Encanto?
Encanto?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Encanto is what it's called.
No, it looks good. It's been on my. I should get around to that one. I've seen good reviews of it.
Have you watched it while you were folding laundry, honey?
No, I legit watched it, and it's good. I liked it.
Cool. All right, one thumb up, folks. All right, what's next? Speaking of, what's his name? Will Smith.
Were we?
Yeah. So
we are now
the reboot of the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air '90s comedy series is apparently on Peacock, entitled Bel-Air, and it's a much more dramatic take on this. I believe Will Smith is executive producer or something. Well, it says his Westbrook Studios produced it. It's kind of interesting. It's very different. It's like the gritty reboot of Prince of Bel-Air.
Do they do like the slow rap? In West Philadelphia, born and raised.
It seems more like it's going to be like The Wire or something, where he's avoiding like gang members and stuff, and not just like, fighting in the streets, but like some serious crime going on that he's avoiding.
Yeah. And I think I read something where this is supposed to be like somebody did this as a gag, right? Somebody did a sort of a spoof trailer of like what a dramatic version of Fresh Prince of Bel-Air could look like. And then it got back to Will Smith. He's like, that's actually a really good idea. And then developed it.
Nice. Cool.
I don't know. I liked, it was a fun series. I don't think I watched every single episode. I watched, definitely, a lot of it. I can't say that there's a lot of allure for me. I don't know. Jaime, are you in on this? Or do you feel like this is an enticement for people? Like, I don't know what the lure is. I guess there's nostalgia, but it's not like it's actually Will Smith. It's not like it's actually a reboot or anything. It's kind of a weird thing.
Yeah, it would probably be more interesting if it wasn't on Peacock, to be quite honest. Like, there hasn't been much on Peacock for me to, collect that one as part of my set of streaming services that I've had. It was like on HBO Max or Netflix or Hulu or Amazon or something, it would probably be something I would go ahead and watch. I just don't feel like going out of my way. It's not such a crown jewel that I would go seek it out like Star Trek has been for Paramount Plus.
It might be interesting, though. I mean, I've watched enough of Fresh Prince, like, just waiting for something to happen. It used to be on in the afternoons, I think. It was in syndication for a long time, right?
Oh, I think it still is, yeah.
Yeah. But, and this obviously has to be where I bring in the Graham Norton reference, as I usually do. There's an episode of Graham Norton, I guess, Will Smith, he's on that show a lot, and he was being interviewed with his son, Jaden, I think, when mm-hmm. I think Jaden and him did a movie together where Jaden was a young teen or played a little kid kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the two of them were on, and they asked, I don't know how often you see Will Smith sing, but they decided to do a singing thing, and they pulled out a special guest, and it was Jazzy Jeff.
Nice.
And they did the Fresh Prince song, the two Smith father and son. And the whole audience got into it. And then there was an extra special guest. I'm going to put a link in the show notes here for the video that's on YouTube and Facebook and stuff like that. But, there were some Tom Jones throwdown. That's all I'm going to say about that.
It's not unusual to be loved by anyone.
Yeah, maybe. That's a hint.
I got it.
Okay. All right. Anyway, so.
So if there's backlash against this, this series when it comes out, can we use hashtag against my will?
Yeah,
I guess.
I don't know. I find the idea of going from like a comedy to a drama to be an unusual twist on something.
The Archies did it.
Considered a classic. You're right. Absolutely right. I mean, Archie was a sort of, you
Sabrina
know.
Did it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's fair. It's fair. But it's unusual. All right. I have one last thing for us, which is came out today that, speaking of our good friends at Peacock, that they've ordered a series reboot. And the reboot, well, this is NBC, I suppose. NBC has ordered a reboot of Quantum Leap. Now, Quantum Leap, for those not necessarily in the know, since it's a 30-year-old sci-fi series, and wow, it hurts a lot to say that. Quantum Leap was a popular NBC sci-fi series, which is a strange thing to say. That,
well, Star Trek was too.
Well, CBS, yeah. Where Dr. Sam Beckett, who's played by Scott Bakula, was a scientist who was trapped in this sort of time loop where he had basically been, you know, his consciousness had been transferred through time, and he kept transferring his consciousness into other people's bodies and into other places in time. He was aided by Dean Stockwell's character. Oh, I can't remember his name off the top of my head. That's going to stick in my brain. Oh, Al. That's right. Al. Dean Stockwell playing Al, who was this sort of hologram of himself, sort of transmitting himself back to the past. He would help him on these adventures. And basically each episode, the Sam character, Sam Beckett, had to go figure out what he was there to sort of correct a wrong that had happened, fix things. And then he would leap to the next place. And the tagline of the show was he never knows if the next leap might be the leap that takes him home. The show went on for 5 years. It was popular, although I think it waned over the course of time. And now apparently they're looking at doing a reboot. Interesting timing in that Dean Stockwell just passed away in November. He was in his 80s, so I don't think they were highly likely to have pulled him out to do this. But it'll be interesting to see if they can pull this off, if it will work.
Cool. Right, and just one little sidebar here, fact-checky kind of real-time follow-up. My reference to Star Trek referred to when it was broadcast on September 8th, 1966, to June 3rd, 1969, on the National Broadcasting Corporation Network, NBC.
There you go.
You're right, I forgot that they're on CBS now, but there you go.
Yep.
Originally there. Which brings us to the reason why we're here, which is talking about Star Trek stuff. And this time, the stuff we're going to talk about is Prodigy, Star Trek Prodigy, Season 1, Episode 7, First Contact. Not First Contact, First Contact. Anyway, so I'm doing a recap this week. And so we start off with Del doing a captain's log. And a very sort of dour, presentation, talking about how the crew is still disturbed by what happened in the last episode, what happened to the previous crew, which I kind of missed. Like, it seemed to be a little bit more more traumatic in the beginning of this show, but I don't remember. Maybe you guys can catch me up. Was there some sort of... I know that we revealed that Chakotay and all that stuff was involved in the last episode, but was there some sort of reveal about what happened to the crew? Or we don't know what happened to the crew, right?
Yeah, I think it's that we don't know what happened to the crew, but I think that was part of the sort of freaky element of it was, oh my God, what happened here? The sort of, you know, what does all this mean?
Yeah, and of course it bothers holographic Janeway too, because she was there too. And there's a scene that they keep cutting to, and she keeps looking at, which is sort of a side story, but it's very, very small and minor in the thing. She's trying to freeze frame and see that there's, you know, some bad guys breaking into the bridge. Anyway, the kids are playing around. They found a distraction to take their mind off their troubles. And they're basically transporting a piece of pie around the ship. And, oh, look, it's still hot and it still tastes good. And because they've discovered the transporter, and they're just intrigued by this whole transporter thing, which we'll come back to in a little bit. But, yeah, so they decide, well, you know, they decide they've got to try it on a live living thing. If the pie survives and it stayed hot, then what else could they do? And, of course, they have to find something indestructible. And we established last week that Murph is relatively indestructible. So they feed him a comm badge, and they decide to beam him from the transporter room onto the bridge, and they all run into the bridge, and they're trying to find him, and of course he's sliding on the outside of the ship on a window, so that they're
so kind apparently of the vacuum of space is not enough to do in Murph either.
Yeah, that's true. He seems to be impervious to that. Anyway, so they do bring him back to the transporter room, and meanwhile they get the incoming distress signal from a ship claiming that they've... This woman there says she's got sick orphans, and they need help and they need rescuing. And Dal kind of goes, "Let me guess, they're suffering from the phage." And the person with the hood on says, "How did you know that?" And he goes, because he immediately recognizes this as a scam, as a Ferengi that he knows. And so the two of them trade insults, and eventually the Ferengi lady convinces them to come over to her ship. And she is, in fact, Damon Nandi, who raised Dal as a young pup. So, voiced by Gray Griffin as well, just from Arkham. Anyway, they beam over, and...
Sorry, who did you have her voiced by?
So, Gray Griffin, according to the titles.
Oh, that's weird. I looked it up on IMDb, and it said Melissa Villaseñor did it.
Really? Oh.
From Saturday Night Live.
Interesting. No, I rolled back the tape and watched the thing. Weird. Huh.
Yeah, maybe. That's an interesting...
That's a fact check for next week. But yeah, she's a voice actor from Batman and a few other things.
Oh, yeah, you know, I know her.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, so they beam over to the Ferengi ship. And just interesting thing, I forgot the name of the sex doll, but just very quickly, and this is obviously an Easter egg for the Star Trek fans. Dal picks up at one of those sex dolls that Picard gets on that planet. What's that thing called?
Oh yeah, for looking for Jamaharon.
Yeah, the icon thing. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
He doesn't talk about it. And of course, he claims he stole the prodigy to save face with his Ferengi stepmom. I guess we'll call her.
Well, because she says, "Oh, you joined the Federation." He says, "No, I stole the ship."
Yeah. And then she says, "I kept your room just the way you left it." And they all crawl underneath the engine because that's apparently where he lived. And there's a Klingon cloaking device in there. And that she says it doesn't work because it needs Chimerian. And, of course, Rock says, "We've got Chimerian and we got lots of it." And of course, Dal's trying to give her the neck cutting gesture to say stop talking kind of thing. And of course, none of them get it. He's like, "Who has Chimerian? We don't have any Chimerian." And of course, Ferengi rules of acquisition, rule number 208, is, I forget what the reference to this, but she says nothing. The only thing more dangerous than a question is an answer. Right. So, anyway, so she decides that they bargain a bit, and she decides that she needs to get this particular crystal. She wants him to do a job for them, for her, right, in trade for the cloaking device. And, she tells them that she wants them to go to the Sherwalax system and to an advanced civilization has never met an alien life. And of course, this is like a first contact situation, right? They have loads of Remolite crystals, which is what she needs. She just needs one. She claims that she owes some people at the, I forget the name of the game that they play, the gambling double. the gambling. She's lost double. A lot of money.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so she's looking for one of these crystals to pay back her debtors and trade. And so she claims that, you know, well, here we can trade them for some with this precious metal object that I've got here. And it turns out it's a Ferengi spit pan. But anyway, so Hollow Janeway says, we need to talk about first contact and how, you know, you can't do anything in the whole Prime Directive. You can't, like, influence the new society in any way. And they for a second there, I thought they were going to get uniforms, but they decided not to use uniforms after all. But it would be kind of funny to see them all in Star Trek uniforms. But so Dal kind of wonders about her emotions and, like, her motives, and he's kind of doubting. And of course, Zero can sense this in Dal, that she knows something's going wrong. But anyway, so they beam down and they don't really find anybody, but they start to realize that the everything around them is kind of animate and storming and circling them. And they determine that these guys the aliens are upset by something. And so Gwyn, who is the de facto communications officer, says, you know, we should bow and, you know, like, so that she were not hostile. And then finally she figures out, well, they must be communicating through harmonics. So she asks everybody to calibrate their tricorders and send out a calming signal, which they do. And of course everything calms down, and the sort of sand builds up and creates this big giant, you know, chamber for them to walk into, sort of a castle kind of deal. And they go inside, and that's when they meet the aliens. And they talk about the, you know, that it's almost like the programmable matter, they call it. She calls it somatic transformations or acoustic terramolding. So they go inside the thing, and they see the crystals hanging from the ceilings, and they're all starting to light up. And it looks pretty interesting. And they determine that they're like, you know, that they're all the crystals are all equally important kind of thing, right? And each crystal is vibrating at its own frequency. So it's kind of like, you know, they determine that they're all part of one big giant voice, as it were. And so the Ferengi gives them the metal plate, and in return, they give her a nice, you know, pleasing song. And, you know, the Ferengi's like upset about the fact she just gets a song. And then so she grabs one of the crystals and grabs a bunch of them and starts running away. And then the crew finds out that this isn't really a diplomatic exchange as what they were told. It's actually the Ferengi's just after getting one of these crystals. And so she grabs the crystals and runs off. And you know, she claims, you know, in her defense that Ferengi rule of accusation number 28, never place friendship above profit. And then so she runs away. And they determine that the crew determine they have to get the crystals back. So they start chasing her, and they're all like, you know, the whole environment is going screwy again. And so they're looking, you know, Dell says, look for an exit. And when she finally catches up with the Ferengi, Nandi, she tells him rule number one of Ferengi acquisition is never give back the money once you have it. And she reveals in the conversation with him that, you know, I thought the being in the mines would have changed you. And he's like, well, how did you know I was in the mines? I was kidnapped. And, you know, you couldn't possibly know that. She goes, I sold you to them. So he turns out that he finds out that she isn't always looking out for his best interests, right? And she said, you should have been taking notes, you know. And she snaps her finger, and her Ferengi ship shows up. So she's stolen the Chimerian crystals from them, from the protostar. She's installed the Klingon cloaking device, and she's stolen the crystals to try and get away from them. And so at the last second, while Dal is in contact with the crystals, he snaps his comm badge onto the crystal. And then they all think that they're done and it's over. And Janeway is upset with them because they've done irreparable harm, and they shouldn't have, you know, they've ignored the Prime Directive, and they broke the rules, and they broke their trust. And now she's, you know, she's broken her trust as well. And then everybody realizes that he can use the transporter to get the crystal back. So they rescue back the crystal, and they give it back to the aliens. Everybody lives happily ever after. And then Dal and Gwyn, in trading their stories, realize that, you know, he's been used by his stepmom, if you want to call her that. And, you know, of course, Gwyn has been, you know, used by her diviner father, and so they realize that the moral of the story is, and I guess we're gonna get morals now, is that they now know who their true friends are. You know, they can't just go with family; they have to go with who their friends are. And as the scene cuts away, the Ferengi's Nandi's robot assistant tells her that there's a reward for the divine for the protostar. So she decides that they should contact the diviner and give them give up Dal and his crew. And of course, she says, "My lobes are tingling," as she thinks about the prophet involved. Now, one thing I want to talk about is that, you know, they all claim they don't know anything about transporters, and yet Dal was a crew member on the Ferengi ship.
Yeah.
And he would have used the transporter before.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Yeah, there's a few holes in this one. It's funny, we joke about it on a somewhat weekly basis, the fact that the show is kind of like Starter Trek, right? It's not Star Trek, it's Starter Trek. That you are basically being fed how the universe works, who things are, what things are, so that when you do eventually graduate to more Star Trek, you'll be ready for all the concepts. So this one was, how does a transporter work? What's first contact? And how does a comm badge work, right? Because we get the setup with Murph at the beginning, they give him the comm badge, and then they lock onto him and they bring him back with the comm badge. So we know that that's going to pay off at the end of the episode, which it does. The transporter again, well, we transported Murph, now we know how the transporter works. Okay, now we know we can transport things back. Okay, so they basically show you how all that works. There's even a line, like, I think it's maybe 2 minutes into the episode, where Jenkum Pog basically soliloquizes and says, like, oh, it does this, 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 and this. Like, it's literally like the Cole's notes of how a transporter works. This episode was a little too paint by numbers for my taste. This one we talked about a little bit last week, but this one really felt like Starter Trek. It really felt entirely predictable, very much felt like this one was aimed more for a younger audience. There was nothing in there where I wasn't like, yep, uh-huh, yep, 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 yep. Not, you know, again, always the voice work is well done. You know, we got a little bit more of the sort of the mystery, the overarching mystery of, you know, how did the protostar end up way out in the far end of the galaxy. But yeah, this was a little bit of a too paint by numbers kids show kind of episode for my taste.
Yeah, definitely. What do you think, Jaime?
I'm a bit intrigued by how this Ferengi ended up in this area. Like, I'm still unclear.
Yeah,
kind of where they're at. Like, did they come closer back to normal sort of space quadrants, or given that Dal apparently knows this person, are they still kind of in the Delta quadrant? Is this, like, there's questions here that kind of get casually ignored in this particular part of the plot.
Yeah, well, it's funny because they do that. The big thing that they do during that sort of hiatus time they have was they turn on the protostar super engine and it fires them across the galaxy. And they say, oh my God, we've transported so far, but they don't say where they ended up. So right now it is very unclear where they're supposed to be relative to Federation space. And I mean, we've only been back for 2 weeks, so there's plenty of time. There's still another, three, four episodes to go this season. I have been just sort of waiting. And when I saw that again, it wasn't just a random Ferengi at the far end of the universe. She was flying a Ferengi vessel very recognizably. So it can't be wildly outside of Ferengi space. It has to be somewhere in the known universe that we're used to from the Star Trek universe. It just makes me wonder where else they're going to go with this.
Yeah, I kind of wonder about that myself. And it's kind of a more modern sort of Ferengi, given that it was a female Ferengi, I think, and clearly into profit and wearing clothes, which is something we know that I can't remember if it was Rom or the Negus before him who made that societal change. So that's kind of a carryover from a Deep Space Nine plot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, she had huge earrings on too, right? So, and voiced by a lady this time too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, definitely very sort of typical Ferengi in terms of that. But I guess, you know, from the point of view, like, you know, like Star-Lord was raised by, you know, his captor slash, you know, forgot the name of the character, but
Yondu, the Ravagers, yeah.
Yeah, that's sort of a, like, you know, for a kid's story, that's kind of creepy, you know. But for a woman to have, you know, been raising and taking care of a young boy, you know, that doesn't sound quite as creepy, even though we all know it's a Ferengi, and no surprise that she sold him to the to the mines, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of a twisted story when you step back from it. You know, he's like, oh, I missed you, or whatever. And she's like, oh, I kept your room the way it was, which, again, is a weird move when you've, like, sold a child into slavery.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't much of a room. I think that was the point, too, when they get in there, right? And it's funny how I think one of them just sort of says under their breath, I don't see the resemblance, right?
Yeah.
Yep. Rocka, probably. Yeah, it's just an interesting episode, but I mean, you know, like I think very, very sort of, you know, like you said, Starter Trek aimed at the young crowd, right? Very
it was kind of a little paint by numbers, which is, you know.
Faux show.
I mean, they're going to do that. Like, we talk about it every week, but they're going to do that. This is what the show is supposed to be for. So, you know, we can't get all bent out of shape and say, oh my God, you know, this isn't how I want it to be. You know, it's not supposed to be on the same par as Discovery, as Picard, as, you know, in certain series here. It's meant to be for a younger audience.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. So we're going to talk about Boba Fett.
It still follows the same split of the past is kind of Dances with Wolves, kind of a white man with the with the natives kind
the
of
white
story.
Hero, yeah.
Like
white.
Yeah, and then the present day is still the mafia story kind of.
So I was thinking about that sort of thing too, because, like, the one thing in the back to tank is whenever he's in the back to tank, he remembers, he's having these sort of almost like dreamlike remembering what was going on, and maybe sort of seeing an idealized version of what he lived through. But I mean, it starts off with him in the back to tank, obviously, and he's traveling, you know, he's on a Bantha. He's going to do a negotiation with the Pikes, I think they're called.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes over there and has a conversation with them, and they're like, well, we're not going to do this, and, you know, we're not going to pay the tribute or whatever, and, you know, you can't make us do that kind of thing. And he's a little disappointed by that. And I think on the way back, he's coming back, and he sees that the, you know, he gives them sort of a threat, says, you know, we'll see how well you do as you try and cross through our lands. And when he goes back and he can see, like, smoke coming from where the village was, and or where the settlement was, because they're nomadic people. And he gets there and they've all been, you know, killed and lit on fire, and he sees a symbol written on one of the tent cloths that it indicates that I've forgotten the name of the characters,
the Nikto gang,
Nikto's had you know, obviously ravished them, and the little kid's dead. So he, you know, builds a pyre and cremates them all and throws the little kid. The little kid had a piece of wood that he was using as his bantha stick. Bantha stick? What do you call it?
Gaffy stick.
Gaffy stick, yeah. And, you know, he puts it into the pyre as well. And then he kind of heads back. And as he's, you know, traveling back to wherever he's going, he's suddenly woken up out of his sleep Karsadan has ripped him out of the back to tank and is beating him up and stuff like that. He's been there to assassinate him or something. And so Boba Fett is, you know, fighting him off as best he can. And then, you know, I forgot about the kids too, right?
He basically drafts the
ne'er-do-wells. Yes.
Yes. He drafts the kids. He drafts them into being his new gang.
Yeah, they're sort of like the mods. Like, they've got these floating mod bikes, like, if you remember from Quadrophenia.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so that's a scene I forgot about. Is he's trying to figure out? I thought, was it this week you talked to he went to see the mayor, and the mayor wouldn't see them, and
this last time he went to see the mayor, spoke with the mayor. The mayor basically told him, like, the Hutts are coming, and then he has the showdown with the Hutts. Yeah. This time he has the person comes to his his building and says, like, the thieves are stealing my water.
Oh, it's, the kids are stealing, yes.
Yeah, so it's Stephen Root, actually. That was very funny. Yeah. A little cameo by Stephen Root. And he comes on and says, you know, yeah, these ne'er-do-wells are stealing my water. Fett goes into town and basically says, you know, hey, you guys need to stop stealing this water. And if, you know, go get a job, basically. And they say, well, there are no jobs. He says, fine, I'll give you a job. And so...
You're working for me now.
Yeah, he hires them and then basically pays off... the Stephen Root character to
pays him less than way less than what he was asking because I mean,
but then he's apparently gouging them, right?
Yeah, he's been gouging everybody. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So anyway, so that's how he gets this gang and these kids, and so they help him fight off the Curse of Stand. Actually, I think I missed the part where the is the chasing at the very end of the episode.
You know, it's the second last thing, I guess.
Okay. So anyway, they're fighting Curse of Stand and. They kind of defeat
Kersantan.
Him.
Kersantan. They actually said it in this episode, thank God.
Yeah, Kersantan. Kersantan. Yeah, Kersantan. And then at some point the Hutts show up, and so he's, you know, he goes out and he talks to them, and they're like, you know, we're leaving, like, this place is like, you know, you guys can have it, somebody worse is coming along to take over, and, you know, what is it, they give him, I forget what he gives them, but they give him back Kersantan.
They give him a Rancor. They give him a Rancor.
Oh, mm-hmm. Rancor. They give him a Rancor. That's right. Yeah. Cause he's got a Rancor now in the thing. And there's a whole scene where he meets the Rancor and gets imprinted on it and all that stuff. Right. But he frees, Kersantan. And I was doing some research on that character because I know you mentioned he's been in the books and I found an article online that sort of explained his relationship, and apparently Boba Fett and they were both bounty hunters at one point. In mm-hmm. fact, both worked for Darth Vader in one story.
They did, yes.
And so they know each other, even though they don't really. I guess they can't really reveal that.
That's why in the last episode he makes a dig when he's standing there talking with the two Hutts.
Yeah.
In the previous episode to this week, he says, "You know, it's not like, you know, beating a Trandoshan when they're sleeping or whatever." That's a reference to a previous experience
encounter. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that's sort of a very deep Easter egg for, you know.
Yeah, for comic readers, yeah.
For comic readers, yeah, for sure. And, so I've kind of mixed up the whole plot line, but they finally decide it. I think, so the Hutts give him the Rancor, he imprints on the Rancor, and I think he doesn't feed anybody to the Rancor this time, right? But
no.
He does go back to meet the mayor, right? And the guy says, oh, well,
it's Major Domo. It's his hilarious Weasley Major Domo.
Yeah. So he goes in, he locks the door, and then next thing you know, they break into the room and there's nobody there, and they realize he's trying to escape. So then, you know, this is the part that was written by George Lucas because there's a car chase scene where
it goes on forever.
Major Domo is like in this car chase scene, and like do they think Star Wars fans want this stuff? I don't know. Like, maybe they didn't. They need to go back and watch Phantom Menace, but or any other movie that George Lucas did. But because I mean, there's this whole, you know, the kids and their little mod bikes chasing this mayor dude or mayor's assistant dude. Yeah, and like you said, it went on for way too long. I mean, super boring. And I forget what happened in the very end. They end up catching up with him, but I forget what happened.
Yeah, he crashes. They basically say, okay, now where's the freaking mayor? And he confesses that the mayor has gone to be with the Pikes. And so that ties us back to the origin part of the story at the beginning,
which is
the Pikes. The Pikes are obviously somebody who Fett has had dealings with in the past, and so that basically ties together.
Okay.
Yeah.
So much of my dream theory.
What was your dream theory?
Well, it just seems to be that whenever he goes in the back of the tank, he flashes back, right? So is that like, or, you know? So I kind of, and like I sort of said, you know how you always, you know, when you have, there's always two sides of the story: is your side, my side, or three sides, I guess, the truth, right? So we're only getting Boba Fett's side of the story, really, because, you know, what do they call, Tusken Raiders are all dead, and, you know, but mind you, he's got the you know, the tools and the weapons of them, so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, there was a lot of stuff in there, lots of good little Easter eggs, lots of funny sort of bits. The Danny Trejo as the keeper. Rancor keeper was the best thing. I was watching him with Xavier and you sort of keep going. They just sort of pan by him for a second first. And I was like, wait a minute. And then they cut by and you see him walking in. And I was like, oh my God, it's Danny Trejo. And I was so excited. I was like, oh, and he's like, so does Danny Trejo just like work in Boba Fett's basement now? I'm like, yeah, I think he totally does. This is awesome.
He's the Rancor keeper. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then they talk about how, you know, the Rancor wasn't necessarily what we experienced in Return of the Jedi, that Rancors are actually very, you know, sensitive creatures that of course they can be trained to be, you know, these, you know, behemoth combatants, but they're actually very intelligent and very thing. And says, you know, yeah, there's stories that the witches of Dathomir, which for fans of Clone Wars will know who the witches are. And you say that they used to ride them into battle. And Fett's like, I want to ride this one, which is fantastic. If that is not a payoff in this season, man, I'll be bummed out. I want to see a fully armored Boba Fett riding into battle on a Rancor. That is the thing I want most in life right now. But yeah, that whole scene was really interesting. It seemed like a bit of, again, a bit long, a bit of a digression, but then you know it's all going to pay off down the road. This sort of connection that he's building with this creature and then that he's going to hopefully ride this sucker into battle against the Pikes or whomever else has done him wrong. So the Black Kersantan thing, although it's funny, they don't call him Black Kersantan, they just call him Kersantan, which I think is probably for the best. I think we're to the point now where we don't need those terms like black. You know, we don't need black lightning. We don't need black. Okay. So Kersantan, it's funny because, you know, we got the cameo of him sort of standing there looking menacing, sort of sneering at Boba and Fennec last episode. This one, we get a little bit more where obviously he comes and he attacks. Personally, I'm a little disappointed. I really think if a Wookiee that size and that vicious catches you in the back to tank, you should just be dead. I really feel like this is another one of those moments where you're like, you kind of want to take it on credit that obviously they're not going to kill, you know, the protagonist of the show in such a fashion. But in those moments, you have to also use that logic and say, there's just no, if you're in the back to tank, you're having a nap, this thing sneaks up on you, reaches in, it should just be able to like crumple your head like a, you know, like a pop can and walk out of the building, you know, like it shouldn't devolve into this huge fight scene and everything anyways. But a pretty good fight scene between, you know, Fett and then Fennec joins in and then the mods join in. And then it's this sort of 6-on-1 fight that leads to the throne room, that leads to the Rancor pit. And then they have the whole exchange where they're like, yeah, we're going to, you know, give Kersantan back to the...
Oh, that's right. They drop him in the Rancor pit. That's how they catch her.
Yeah.
Him.
And then they're like, okay, fine. So then they're going to march him back into town and they, you know, the Hutts show up. They give him the Rancor as a tribute. He offers to give Kersantan back to them. They're like, well, we don't want him. And so they just sort of let him go and he sort of wanders off into the desert. I hope that pays off down the road with, you know, perhaps Kersantan returning. Although it feels kind of like that was it. I feel like maybe that was kind of all they were going to do with Kersantan. I don't know what else. They do leave on good terms. You know, Boba basically says, like, you know, you paid to do a job. I get it. You know, no hard feelings. Which is, you know, obviously, again, shows that difference between him and Jabba. But to have Kersantan sort of appear, look tough for a cameo in the first part, and then come back, have this one fight scene, and then just be like run off into the desert is like, it's a little disappointing. I kind of wanted more. But then same thing with the Hutts, the whole sort of Hutt storyline. Like, oh, we're coming here. And the big mystery now is they're saying like, well, somebody else has laid claim to this. Who else has laid claim to this? And so it sounds like it's the Pike Syndicate, because the Hutts leave saying another syndicate has laid claim to this territory. Mm-hmm. We're out of here. We're not here for a war. We're leaving. And they don't actually say it's the Pikes, but then they go into town to check in with the mayor. The mayor is gone. The major domo leads them on that ridiculously long car chase scene. And then he confesses, yeah, he's gone to be with the Pikes. The Pikes are a syndicate. They're the spice smuggling syndicate. So I think we're supposed to see that all this is coming back around to the Pikes versus Boba and his gang as it sort of pays forward. I did think it was kind of a weird, again, just such a stereotypical trope. And it's funny because this show has been kind of idiosyncratic. It's not just, it's using archetypes, but it's not using stereotypes. The whole, you know, white savior, although, you know, obviously Temuera Morrison's not white, but just the idea of the, you know, the other comes in, the indigenous people adopt him, show him their ways, and then they, you know, he leaves, they're slaughtered, he comes back, they're gone. He, you know, has this as motivation for moving forward. I feel like that's just a little bit of a worn piece of territory as well. And it does kind of, it kind of diminishes this whole first two episodes. It kind of just sort of resets everything back to, oh, he's on his own again. He's got these new skills. He's kind of learned new ways, but, you know, now he's this sort of different type of thing. But all those relationships, all the, like, it just, it's just kind of a weird to have done all this, like, you know, he's learned from these people and everything else, and to have them just completely wiped out is just kind of a little anticlimactic. I don't know.
Yeah, and where does he get this whole sort of, like, I'm a benevolent leader sort of thing? I mean, like, you know, he was pretty badass in Empire Strikes Back, you know?
Yeah, and I guess the whole idea is that, you know, in coming out of the Sarlacc and surviving that, and then surviving and becoming part of the ways of this, of the Sand People, I guess we're supposed to say that he's been reborn, that this is the new him.
That's a redemption, yeah.
You know, and we see that even when he appears first in The Mandalorian, he sort of, you know, obviously he kicks ass, but he's just a different, he seems much more sort of, you know, in control, and sort of has a new lease on life. And he says explicitly in this series a couple of times, you know, I'm not a bounty hunter anymore. Although wanting to be the daimyo, to be the crime boss that controls the area, is also a strange move. If you're like, well, I don't want to be a bounty hunter anymore, that's not right. But what I'm going to do is be the crime lord who people have to pay off in order to live here. Yeah,
for protection, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of not exactly the most noble move. So it does still sort of, it's sort of strange and skirting. The one thing that I'm kind of curious to see how this continues to play out is, so the only other series that we've really seen the crime world of Star Wars explored, and we saw it obviously in Clone Wars, we've seen a little bit of it in Bad Batch, we've seen a little bit of it in Rebels, but the only movie live action thing that really sort of gets into the crime world beyond a little bit of Jabba the Hutt is in Solo. And in Solo, the sort of big payoff is that, you know, Han Solo, the love of his life before Princess Leia, is Kira, right? And Emilia Clarke, of course, the Game of Thrones famous actress, plays Kira in that. I can't help but keep wondering if there isn't a payoff somewhere in here where we tie back into the Black Sun Syndicate, into the crime world, into the world that Kira lives in this era too.
Right.
Because they just keep talking about, like, the crime syndicates in the world and stuff like that. Like, we know that there's a relationship between the Pikes and the and Black Sun. Like, I wonder if this is all going to come back around. Maul in this era, spoilers. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Maul's dead at this point. So there's no chance we're going to see Maul show up. But Kira is still on the table as sort of head of a huge crime syndicate. Kind of a twist where it could go. She could be, you know, a really great sort of nemesis for Fett, controlling the larger crime world, you know, making life hard for him. I think it'd be interesting. I don't know if it's going to come to pass, but that was where my brain started going the other day when they were talking about, like, because it went from like, oh, the Hutts are here. Oh, the Hutts are scared. Okay, the Hutts are scared. Why are the Hutts scared? Okay, well, the Pikes are coming. Is it the Pikes? Is it, like, who's controlling the Pikes? So I just can't help but think that this is all leading towards a bigger reveal.
Well, the part I forgot about the Pikes was when he goes to negotiate with them and says, you pay me protection and I'll make sure you have safe passage. And they're like, why should we pay you protection? We're already paying somebody else protection.
Well, they're already paying the Nikto gang, right? And
yeah,
then,
yeah.
And then, so now he's come back home, found that the Nikto gang has clearly killed all of his folks, people. Yeah. So yep. Now the next episode, the flashback scene has to be him wiping out the Nikto gang. And then I don't know where it goes after that. I don't know if this whole sort of...
What I'm saying, though, is the Pikes don't seem to be by themselves, you know, like they're, like you said, they're controlling something, but like,
oh, yeah.
If they're paying off somebody to protect them,
yeah,
sort of deal, right?
Yeah. Jaime, any conspiracy theories? Any moments that jumped out at you?
How was your dinner?
Yeah. Dinner was good. The episode was fine. I am curious as to where they're going to go. What are we, about halfway through the series? Do we say it was 7 or 8 episodes?
Yeah, 7, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. So we're already halfway,
yeah. Yeah. And when he took the gang of teenagers and made them part of his gang, I thought for sure he was going to make the Wookiee part of his gang too. Of like, hey, why don't you work for me now?
Since that would have been amazing. I would have highly endorsed that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess they kind of leave it open that maybe he could still come back and do that. But we'll see what happens there, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, having read a number of the comic series and continuing to read a number of the Star Wars comic series, Kersantan isn't just an ass, like just an absolute monster. He's not, you know, it's funny because, you know, I've seen a couple things out online this week saying, well, Kersantan, he owes him a debt and he'll come back. Listen, unless they suddenly and you know, fundamentally change this character, he's not coming back to do a nice thing for Fett. He's off to his next thing. Like, at one point, he kind of turns his back on Darth Vader. Like, they just, you know, like, there's not there's not a lot of honor in Black Kersantan. He's kind of he's just genuinely a monster. So it'll be interesting to see if they try and sort of redeem him in some way or make sort of some sort of pathological need to repay Fett for sparing his life or something. Cause that's not who he is in the books, I'll tell you, but I'm loving it. I love it. I was really kind of cool on the first episode. It was too short and it didn't give me enough, but combining that with the sort of stuff we built on the second episode and then a little more in the sort of quote unquote present and a little less in the past in this episode, which is a flip to how they've done the first two episodes. I enjoyed that. I'm enjoying the now a little more than the past. I understand why we're doing the past and why it's fundamental to understanding the character, but I'm definitely enjoying the where we are in the same time period that Mandalorian happens, same time period that Ahsoka happens. Now we've got this. So we're going to have, like, at some point, 3 or 4 series that are sort of happening in a concurrent timeline, which will hopefully lead to some sort of Netflix Defenders-esque kind of crossover series between all these things or something. I definitely am enjoying the now more than the then.
And this is 5 years past Return of the Jedi? Is that where we are?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I did like the part in the past where he takes the swoop into town and he's going to go talk to the Pikes about collecting his dough. And he drives past people putting stormtrooper heads up on pikes. And he's like, about that?
Yeah.
and he just sort of has the moment of,
but like, are those pikes? Like, those, is that where the pike reference comes from?
No, pike is different, but no, it's, I think the idea is just that he's unaware. He's disconnected. Like, he's out in the Outer Rim. He's in Tatooine. He's been out in the desert with the Tuskens. He doesn't really know that in the same time frame after he got out of the Sarlacc and then he's been out in the desert with them and recovering and everything else, the Empire fell during that period. That's when the Emperor died. That's when Vader died. Death Star 2 blows up. And the galaxy kind of turns against, as much as it can, against the Empire.
The Empire, yeah.
So that is where we're starting to see the bleed through of even as far out as Tatooine, the locals were like, listen, you've got no leg to stand on. And they clearly, you know, dispatched the local garrison of stormtroopers and are putting their helmets up on pikes saying, if you're a former stormtrooper, you might want to think twice about trying to come back here and reestablishing your order.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, let's move on to our watch list then. And you're up first, I guess.
Me? Yes. This week we got our first trailer for Human Resources. Human Resources is a long known to be coming spin-off series based on Big Mouth from Netflix. And it's based on the creatures that are showing up, the hormone monsters, I can't even remember them all, the snakes, the shame wizard, all the different creatures that show up and torment and help the children in Big Mouth, they all come from this sort of central location, which we actually have seen a couple of times. We've gotten glimpses into the world of them, and it's kind of an office comedy situation. And so now they're doing an entire spin-off series based on like what it's like to be in that office space. They're going to do a workplace comedy basically set in that world with all these characters and what they do in their downtime and you know how they relate to each other and everything else. So yeah, first trailer went up this week. It's coming on March 18th, so not too far away, a couple months. And for fans of Big Mouth, I think this is going to be a real cool little add-on to that universe, because the humor hopefully will carry over. Obviously it's a little less focused on the identifiable kid characters, but hopefully the filthiness and hilariousness will continue.
Cool.
The other thing I threw on here was, yes, The Eternals. So The Eternals came yesterday to Disney Plus. Jaime, I don't know if you've already jumped on that one or if you're saving it for the weekend.
I have not seen it yet. I probably am going to wait for the weekend.
Yeah. I don't know that I will watch it immediately, like in the next couple of days. I have a few other things I'd like to get through, but I do think it's probably worth a second watch just to sort of validate my initial thoughts and sort of give it that. I think I'm curious to see it another time and sort of see how it holds up and see if my memories of it are you know, where I indeed feel about it. So yeah, that's definitely on a to-do. I was thinking about, we had talked about when will Spider-Man No Way Home show up on streaming, and that's kind of why I put Eternals here. I wanted to sort of springboard off of that too. So the challenge is that because No Way Home is a Sony product, technically, not a Disney product, it's not going to Disney Plus. So therefore, the 45-day rule, which would have brought it out in early February, does not apply. It really is its own thing. And where Sony Pictures is putting its products is Netflix. So if you want to watch the Sony Spider-Man movies, all of them, which includes, you know, the animated Miles Morales movie and other things, those are all on Netflix. So I suspect, and I may be wrong, but I suspect where we will see it eventually is on Netflix, not on Disney Plus. And as to when it's going to appear, I'm not sure, given the fact that it is not beholden to those rules that Disney has set up for itself. I still think we're likely to see it probably in late February or March, although I've seen unsubstantiated rumors online, and take it with a grain of salt because that's exactly what it is, that it's coming to on-demand and to home video, so DVD, Blu-ray, 4K, whatever, at the end of February, No Way Home is. So if that's the case there, does it come out onto a streaming service immediately thereafter? Do they give it a chance to sell for a bit before they move it onto there? Is it not going to come till then, April or May? So I guess what I'm saying is it could be a while before you have a chance to watch on the streaming service, which leads me to, hey, Jaime, would you purchase a digital copy or a physical copy of No Way Home to watch it if it was available much sooner than you anticipate it being available on the streaming service?
I suppose it depends on how much more in advance. Like, if I had to wait another, let's say, 3 months, I probably would not. Maybe? I don't know. I mean, I did watch Black Widow, so I guess if it was that, I might do that. If it was 6 months, I think certainly 3 months is a little harder to figure out.
Mm.
But again, now that I think about it, I did do Black Widow, so maybe I would.
So I guess I'd like an update too. How spoiled or unspoiled have you been about the events that transpired in No Way Home now that it's been out in the public for 6 weeks-ish or so?
Relatively unspoiled, I think, for No Way Home, and still somehow relatively unspoiled for Eternal. So I think I'll be okay for those.
Hmm. That's good. I'm glad for you. I mean, again, I genuinely, I have been worried for you because Eternals, they're just not massive spoilers. There's a couple of scenes where you're like, oh, okay. But No Way Home definitely has, you know, there's some stuff that obviously you can put two and two together and get four from watching the trailers or, you know, whatever else. But there are certainly some twists in there that that are more challenging to see coming. And I was worried very much that between social platforms and blogs and Reddit and everything else that that stuff would leak out. So, yeah, I'm glad that you still are hopefully going to be able to go into that stuff clean. So it's still a surprise and an enjoyable experience. But, yeah, boy, it's... They don't make it easy on you, do they?
No.
So for me, the I just sat and watched the first 20 minutes of The Eternals, because if you remember the story back from the summer, I didn't get into the theater until 20 minutes into the film.
That's right.
And so I sat down and watched the first 20 minutes. It does reveal a bit more of the sort of how we get from point A to point B, where the movie starts proper. But to be honest with you, it doesn't really help. You know, it does establish the Jon Snow and Emma from, or Gemma from
Humans.
Relationship, you know. So because they have a relationship that turns up at the end, and you find out what happens here. And then I've forgotten the name of the little tiny character.
Sprite.
Sprite, yes, of course, Sprite, duh. And, you know, a little bit of the reason why, the Jon Snow's older brother. Richard Madsen. Yes. Yeah, the Richard Madsen character, like, where he is. And
yeah,
a bit confusing with some of the flashes, like, it starts off way back in the past, and it bounces forward to, starts in Mesopotamia, then it comes forward to now, and then it goes back to, you know, 500 BC or something like that, or 500 AD or whatever. BC must be BC, and they introduce some of the other characters, and then you know it bounces around a lot, this movie. Mm-hmm. It doesn't help. I mean, it's like, you know, my own criticism about it, and I'm not going to spoil it too much for Jaime, is that they're introducing this brand new group of characters to an audience that has no frame of reference to them, right? And it's, I don't know if it's really that explained that well. I mean, yeah, they've got these really cool powers. What, you know, like, you know, and the dude who's like inventing the plow and, you know, the other things that, you know, like, he's like, are they trying to say that they were responsible for that? And then, of course, you know, point blank, Jon Snow says, how come you didn't help with Thanos?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'll leave that on the table for you guys. But yeah, so it was interesting to watch. I mean, so let's put it this way. I watched the first 20 minutes of the movie. I've seen everything beyond there. And maybe it's fresh in my mind, or it wasn't, you know, an earth-shattering movie that I really want to go back and watch it again. But yeah, I just kind of went, oh, this is where I came in, and just stopped watching it. So I might go back and finish it. Who knows?
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm in the middle of trying to finish, you know, Daredevil and watching other things that are more interesting to me than this is right now. So
how are you enjoying Daredevil?
Good. I just watched the first episode of season 3, which is kind of, you haven't watched any of that yet, right?
So did you watch Defenders?
I have not watched Defenders yet. Are you supposed to watch Defenders in between?
Yeah. So season 1 and season 2 sort of work cohesively somewhat, although again, the whole Netflix thing works better if you watch like all the Netflix series in the order which they came, because they do kind of piggyback each other. But season 3 very much piggybacks off of what happened. Like, Daredevil is kind of the central character of
there's a big conflagration that apparently just happened, and I don't know anything about
it. Yes, so that is what happens in Defenders. So okay. You don't have to
know what happened there, because they spoiled it for me by telling me what happened in the end of. But yeah, so, and am I supposed to go watch The Punisher too, or what?
No, you don't have to watch Punisher. I mean, you should. It's really good. I enjoyed season 1 of The Punisher very much, but more so than I thought I would. But in order to get a satisfying ending to the Elektra Daredevil story from season 2 of Daredevil, you should watch. So you might want to stop where you are on season 3 and just watch. It's only like, it's 5 or 6 episodes. For Defenders, it's not the greatest crossover of all time. As a matter of fact, it's not the best.
I mean, do I need to watch Luke Cage and Iron Fist?
You don't have to. You could certainly pick up enough of the characters. Again, it's probably more satisfying if you know more about those characters, because they all kind of, all of their story arcs kind of build towards that. But really, if you're just watching it just from simply a Daredevil perspective, you'll still get what you need out of it, because it is the bow on the Elektra and Matt Murdock story. Before you jump into season three, because season three really deals with the ramifications of
that. I get that.
Because
there is kind of there's an ending in season two that's just kind of climactic, and then there's like a gap, and it's like, because where it comes in, clearly I missed something, and I wasn't sure if I'm supposed to have missed something or whatever, but makes sense. Clear as mud.
Yes.
So over to Jaime and his pick, and then we'll come back to mine.
Yeah, mine is parkmyspaceship.com, and there's a little article here that explains that the original Death Star is the same size of the Olympic Peninsula, which is close to where I live. It's very close to Seattle.
Okay.
And looking at some fun stuff, because I was thinking, all right, what are the size of some of these things? So the Galaxy Class Enterprise D is roughly the same length as the distance from Safeco Field, the very south end of it. And the other end, there's a bit of a gap here, but the other end is the north end of Lumen Field, where the Seahawks play. So where the Seattle Mariners play and the Seattle Seahawks play and the Seattle Sounders play, I have a pretty good intimate feel for how big that is. So it's kind of nice to see, relative to landmarks that I know, how big the Galaxy Class Enterprise D would be. And then you can do things, you know, like, I'm not familiar with Toronto, so I can't speak to it, but, you know, pick something like Deep Space Nine and try to compare it to your fair city area. For me, Deep Space Nine is roughly the size of our Green Lake. So I kind of have an idea of how long it would take me to walk around the promenade, the habitat ring on the outside.
Yeah, I think there's a fun, you know, I was laughing. I was re-listening to last week's episode to do some fact check, and I was laughing hysterically. One of my favorite things is when Jaime measures things in Canada's. And I was thinking about that. We'll have to start figuring out like landmark equivalents for hypothetical space vehicles. Like, we have to base them on like sort of nationally known landmarks, though. Like, compare, you know, the Galactica from Battlestar Galactica to the Empire State Building. Compare the.
Have you not seen that video that's on?
I have. It's just. Yeah, but again, those compare them to each other. They don't compare them to.
Oh, there's the Eiffel Tower in there.
Oh, is there? Like, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a fun way of measuring, like, you know, how many Godzillas fit in the, you know, different things.
The head of the pin?
Fun measurement stuff. But
yeah.
I think we should measure things in Timbits, actually.
Well, that's for volume. We do that for volume. How many Timbits fit in a coffee cup, right?
Yeah, or how many Timbits fit in a school bus. Yeah,
exactly. So I don't have a good sense of anything around Toronto, so I'm still using Deep Space Nine. I decided to choose Mississauga, and I think I'm looking at, like, the airport or something.
That's where the Toronto International Airport's actually in Mississauga.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
Toronto's Pearson its own airport, but it's teeny tiny. Yeah, it's Lester Pearson Airport, yeah. He was one of our prime ministers. Prime ministers like a president, only, you know, less important.
And a pushover when it comes to, like, you know, abandoning your supersonic jets.
Yeah, that.
Was that Diefenbaker or was that Pearson?
I think it was Diefenbaker.
Pearson versus Eisenhower, right?
Yeah. And somewhere in there, we lost.
Do you know about the Avro Arrow, Jaime? Have you ever heard of that?
No, I don't think I have.
So Canada in the 50s, late 50s, built a supersonic fly-by-wire computer-controlled jet plane, and they had orders from France, and they were trying to sell them to the Americans, and for some reason, all of a sudden, they just scrapped the whole program. They built five of them, and they basically, four of them were destroyed, and one of them is missing, so they don't know where it is. Some people say it's in the bottom of the lake, and some people say
that's where the models went, yeah.
Yeah, well, they destroyed most of them and threw them in the lake. And so there's actually been one in Hamilton Airport that's been rebuilt. or built from the plans and stuff like that. But it was a huge, huge deal. And apparently the story is that when the Eisenhower was saying, well, you know, we can put our nuclear warheads in northern Canada and point them at the United States, but I mean, point them at the USSR. But if you don't get rid of the Arrow, we're going to put them along the border of the United States, and they might accidentally land in Canada. So, yeah, there was some. They claim that there's all kinds of conspiracies, and I know there's plots been written and stories have been written about, you know, what happened to the missing CF-105 and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, check it out.
Yeah, it's a pretty. They've done like, you know, TV movies and stuff about the story of the Arrow Avro. It's a pretty famous Canadian.
Starring Dan Aykroyd.
Starring Dan Aykroyd, yeah. You're right.
Yeah.
Noted Canadian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so check that out. So my pick this week is, it wasn't really a pick, I just sort of, I watched a bit of The Eternals, I'm watching some Daredevil, a few other things on TV, probably something I'm forgetting. Oh, I have the app, I can look that up. But today and yesterday I watched Predestination, which I kind of stumbled across on Netflix. It's an older movie from 2014 starring Ethan Hawke. It's a very sort of strange, timey-wimey story, and it's based on a Heinlein novel, and so I'm used to, I like Heinlein's writing, so I wanted to watch this and see if I could get the gist of it. It is very similar to the kind of stories that Heinlein wrote. And I'm not going to go too much into it, but there's a paradox in the movie, and you're trying to sort of figure it out. And it does, like as Jonathan says, it what's the word you say, telegraphs?
Oh, yeah, foreshadows for sure.
Foreshadow, yeah, definitely. I don't know if you've seen the movie, Jonathan, but it does sort of, it's very easy to figure out where the plot's going, I find, you know.
Yep.
Yeah, and, you know, even the big reveal at the end, you're like, yeah, I saw that coming like a half an hour ago. So maybe I've been hanging around with you too long, but...
Sorry.
It's an interesting movie from a timey-wimey kind of point of view, but yeah, it's sort of... actually, I guess the last little reveal was a bit... they did catch me by surprise, but the whole sort of how it unravels didn't really sort of surprise me, but it's a decent movie. It's not, you know, I think it's... probably like a grade B sci-fi flick, but definitely worth watching. If you're on Netflix, I mean, you're not paying anything for it other than, you know, some time. So it's definitely a good 2-hour romp, you know.
Cool.
And that's it for me. And I guess that's it for another week. So, hey, hi, if people want to get in touch with you, where would they find you?
I'm on Twitter as @DevOfTheHair.
And Jonathan, people want to get in touch with you?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram as @JPKNews.
All right. My name is Tim Mitra, TimMitra, on the Twitcher machine is where you'll find me. And so until next time, we'll say bye-bye.
Bye.
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 See you in the future.
You've been listening to the Spotcast Podcast. If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the Spotcast website at spotcast.com. You can get in touch with us on the website or follow us on Twitter at Spotcast. If you have feedback or questions, send us a tweet with the hashtag AskSpotcast. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/Spotcast. You can find details on how to help us on our website, spotcast.com/sponsor us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the future.
Bidey?
Bidey?
Is everyone saying Bidey?
Bidey.
Howdy and Bowdy?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Tim, was it right your pick wasn't the NFT?
Yeah, really.
Oh, the NFT, yeah. Oh, yeah, we didn't talk about the NFT. We can talk about it now. So, yeah, we were talking yesterday on More Than Just Code with Mark, and he was going on about NFTs and telling us about how he'd created one, and, you know, they were profiting like Ferengis with them. So I figured, you know, what the hell? So I went onto the site he was talking about and poked around a bit. I have some Bitcoin, so I decided to, you know, just, I mean, my Bitcoin is pretty much found money because I got in, not super early, but I got in early about 3 or 4 years ago when we talked about it on the other podcast. And you know, I invested like $50 just to see what would happen. And it's, you know, increased itself 10 times. So I don't mind spending a few bit of that found money on this technology. But yeah, so I posted up the, it took the holographic Spotcast logo and turned it into an NFT and put it up on the site. And I also took our MTJC logo. So I'm just trying to figure out how to, you know, turn it into an actual one that people can buy and that kind of stuff. So it's kind of cool. So who knows? Well, and as an artist, I'm curious about it because, you know, people are talking about creating original artwork and turning them into NFTs, and I'm not going to get paid for my paintings while I'm alive. I might as well get paid for some NFTs, right?
It's one way to go at it.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And maybe I can profit by helping other artists do the same thing. And, you know, following the rules of acquisition, of course, right?
Yeah, really.
Mm-hmm. Yes, siree, Bob.
So are you intending to watch all of the Netflix Marvel shows, or are you just sticking to Daredevil?
I've already finished off the Jessica Jones, right?
Oh, okay.
So I didn't watch the Defender thing. I think it was between 2 and 3 as well, right? But
yep.
So I did intend to watch Defenders at some point. I don't know if I'm going to go. I don't think I see any reason to see Iron Fist, and I might watch Luke Cage, but
yeah, Iron Fist is not, it's not great, but there's enough there. Season one is a bit weak. Season two definitely is an improvement because it's funny because it actually turns the focus more towards one of the supporting characters
who is, yeah, you were saying,
more interesting than him. Yeah, I mean, you do not have to watch it. It fills in some puzzle pieces, but it's not the end of the world if you miss out on that one. But Luke Cage is actually pretty strong. Like, the season one villain for Luke Cage is Mahershala Ali, who is, you know, an Oscar-winning, tremendously talented mm-hmm. actor. So, I mean, he kind of blows the screen away when you're watching that first season. You're just like, oh my God. Like, I don't know that I had seen too much with him before I had seen that, because that came out, whatever, 5 years ago, 6 years ago. I just remember being like, who is this guy? Like, he's amazing. So he's worth the price of admission on his own. And then Alfred Woodard plays the sort of the secondary villain in season one and the main villain in season two. And she's, again, quite captivating, you know, very nuanced, very, very, very well done character as well. So, yeah, I would say Luke Cage is definitely mm-hmm. worth a watch. And Punisher, again, I was, you know, Punisher is a major part, obviously, of season two of the Daredevil series. I wasn't sure how I was going to feel about a series just focused on that, because it was very dark, grim, violent, you know, the whole thing. But it was far, far more enjoyable the first season than I thought it would be. And season two is actually something I'm going to watch starting probably this weekend. So I would say, yes, that's definitely worth a watch as well. So, I'd say in the end, like, there's value in watching all of it, but I'd say if you're going to drop anything, Iron Fist would be the first one to drop.
Yep, cool.
But right. Yeah, Defenders is worth it just for the sort of satisfactory conclusion to that Matt Murdock, Elektra, story. It does kind of wrap up overlapping events between Iron Fist, Luke Cage, Jessica Jones, and Daredevil, the first two seasons, or first season of a couple of those, and then second season of a couple of those. So it does kind of bring those all together. But if you just go in as a Daredevil fan, you've already watched Jessica Jones, you already know that, you'll certainly get enough of it. And it really does kind of center on Matt and his story, and wrapping up the Elektra story, because that really is kind of over with when you get into season three, and you kind of need to know where that went.
Cool.
Separately, I happened to log into HBO Max because you guys asked. Looks like Peacemaker dropped 3 episodes.
Yep.
Looks like they come out at on Wednesdays. Looks like the first 3 episodes are 46 minutes, 40 minutes, and 39 minutes.
Do you know how many they're doing in the season? Or
no, I should look that up. Peacemaker, no, it's not 3. Good job, Google. How many will they have?
That's how many they have episodes. Now.
8 episodes is what the Hollywood Reporter said, so that's probably about right.
Yeah, so you couldn't possibly get through it in the time that you plan to subscribe unless you add on another month.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I was just thinking, so it did pop up on Crave here, which is sort of our HBO side equivalent. And so they also just put up the Suicide Squad, the James Gunn version, last month. So I was thinking, oh, that's good. I can actually sit down one of these days and watch Suicide Squad, and then from there I can piggyback into Peacemaker. So that's kind of a nice plus for us. Obviously, you got that through HBO previously anyways, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. We'll put that on my to-do list. It never gets shorter, that to-do list.
No.
It's growing and growing and growing.
Yeah. It's a thing.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.